Hello and welcome to this episode of the Collaborative Care Lab podcast. In this recording, Selma is speaking to medical anthropologist Dr. Jamie Sarris about his work in Ireland on addiction, mental health and elderly care. Dr. Sarris is currently Associate Professor of Anthropology at Maynooth University.
Hello and a warm welcome to Dr. Jamie Sarris.
Hi there.
Hello. Could you tell us about your ongoing work on epilepsy and public health, and specifically in reference to expert practitioner groups and how your research methods contributed to how you reached your conclusions?
Okay. I mean, I actually got sort of dragged into epilepsy through the question of care much more than, you know, a direct interest in epilepsy. And that project actually shows how creative funding mechanisms can facilitate types of collaboration around care. And so the grant that work was funded on is modest size, is about 300,000 euro. But it was part of the Health Research Board in Ireland's attempt to kind of figure out how to improve kind of care closer to the coalface. They had traditionally funded places, you know, like basic research. I don't know if you're familiar with TRL, technology readiness. I don't know what the L is for off the top of my head. But sort of zero to three is sort of basic research. And then there's stuff that's kind of translational research, and they were trying to find a way to fund work at 9 and 10, that is work that's really just being delivered to care. And they ring-fenced money that went directly to the basically the clinical care units, so epilepsy was one of those. And they approached me and we got to talking about, you know, kind of what they knew they were doing. And because they kind of knew pretty well what they were doing, quite unusually for care systems, they knew kind of where their edges were and where they were having problems. And so what they wanted was a kind of research project that was looking at aspects of how they did things normally and the kind of gaps in, you know, that they kind of knew were there, and also the unknown gaps. And so the kind of iron rule of healthcare research is anthropologists are approached pretty much as a last resort when, you know, kind of every other version of healthcare research has proven, the problem has proven intractable. Then we get invited on to do something. And I think in this case, to the Epilepsy Services credit here, they decided that they were interested in, you know, not replicating the kind of work that had been done in Ireland, mostly with sociologists and statisticians and the odd psychologists, but to try to understand their situation holistically. The expert practitioners was that's the kind of term we played around with, but the idea was that we would do this project on how patient-centeredness worked in the epilepsy services and the kinds of things that, you know, tended to facilitate it and the kinds of things that tended to make it more of a problem. But my goal, at least from early on, was to sort of leave in place the capacity for small-scale research projects being run, say, by a nurse, an APN, whatever, to look at what day-to-day practice was like, and that they're both everything from the constitution of the research through its kind of, you know, whatever lessons learned being implemented were kind of completely owned within the care system. I think that's the only way that change can actually happen. There's in quality and patient safety literature, there's a saying that more or less is that, you know, change doesn't happen until habits change, until it becomes habitual. And I think that that's really where the next step for how care systems as a whole work is habitually both making time for and having the capacity to do small scale imaginative looks at, you know, reflective looks at what your practice is and how to make it better. And so that project was kind of broadly in that space.
Wonderful, thank you. So moving on to your work titled Dialectical Opiates and the other one, Hungry Subjects, could you tell us about your findings regarding the parallels with heroin users and their treatments on methadone, as well as the mental health connections?
Well, I've been working with heroin users, I suppose, going on more than about 20 years, really. I co-led one of the first prevalence studies in Ireland, you know, trying to figure out valid statistical ways, but attaching it to sort of ethnographic methodologies of how to estimate hidden usage based on the users that actually people knew. And so the obvious thing at that time, and it's still one of the more stable ways of counting users in most countries, is the number of people who are officially in treatment. And for most of Europe, officially in treatment means you're in legal receipt of methadone. This wasn't the happiest of projects at the end. It basically ended in tears, which often happens in these situations where, you know, I wasn't the first person in Ireland to find this, but, you know, this, myself and my colleague, Catherine Comiskey, documented it pretty extensively that a lot of people who are using methadone are simultaneously using heroin. And by the same token, a lot of methadone is used outside of the central treatment list. That is, it's a street drug. Now, you wouldn't be surprised that the more you, you know, if you have any kind of ethnographic background or interest, that the more you look at this, the more complicated it actually becomes. And one of the problems that we fell afoul with the funder that time, one of the problems was that if you're the sort of statistical baseline that you're estimating from has some of the hidden usage in the baseline, then a lot of the statistical techniques become impossible. Most statistical techniques at SPSS, just by the by, this is a problem in how anthropologists are trained on this side of the Atlantic rather than in the United States, where you are likely to have gone through a statistics course at university before you necessarily went into anthropology at graduate school, is that most statistical problems, real world statistical problems, are trivial or impossible. If the assumptions hold, then SPSS is grand and you just feed the numbers in and you get some kind of curve or some kind of, you know, very nice graph to demonstrate something. If the assumptions don't hold, the actual work can be next to impossible. The actual mathematics involved is very, very challenging. So the questions about, you know, when you get funded by a government body and you come back to say, look, there's a really fundamental flaw with how you're kind of thinking about this, you tend not to win a lot of friends. But at that point, it became obvious to me that heroin and methadone existed in very, very complicated kinds of relationships. And that was just about the time where a kind of new wave, I'm about a half a generation removed from most of this, but a new wave of folks who were kind of getting their PhDs in the early 2000s, more or less, 2000 to say 2006, 7, 8, we're getting interested in addiction in novel ways. And some people, you know, that come to mind would be Angela Garcia, who wrote The Pastoral Clinic, very lovely, well-written ethnography about Hispaniola heroin use in the Hispaniola Valley in New Mexico, one of the highest heroin usages in the United States. You know, trying to not so much move outside of medical frames or criminal justice frames of addiction, but to sort of understand the day-to-day lives of people who were, you know, kind of using heroin. I suppose you say the granddaddy of that work might have been Michael Agar's Ripping and Running, which was a kind of early work on heroin users in the early 1970s. But the questions around that was really, you know, the tribe of heroin users. And in Agar's work, there is this real, you know, kind of thing. And I was quite uncomfortable with that idea. And so it was a challenge to sort of frame something that was ethnographically possible, that was simultaneously kind of useful. And I suppose that that piece, Dialectical Opiates, is really a retrospective look at my own kind of career doing that. It's a special, it's coming out in the special edition of the Irish Journal of Psychological Medicine. It's where the majority of Irish psychiatrists would actually kind of do their reading. And it says something. I mean, it's taken a long time. I'm not the only one. My students are involved in this as well. But like, you know, to sort of have one of the major national medical journals, you know, come to you as a medical anthropologist and say, you know, we're interested in what you're doing. And, you know, could you write some kind of piece to kind of lessons learned might be a little strong, but that sort of retrospective. So that's the kind of impulse behind that particular piece. And I try to connect it to other work, particularly in the United States, Hansen's work in New York. She's a really interesting psychiatrist, PhD anthropologist out of Yale, where she talks about the racialization of certain kinds of opiate substitutes. So the difference between buprenorphine and methadone in the United States, particularly the eastern coast of the United States, where the former has now been racialized as white, is routinely paid for by private insurance and is distributed in a doctor's office. The latter remains a freely available but public drug. It's distributed in public clinics, and the people who use it are overwhelmingly poor and statistically higher than average people of color. The real point is that neither heroin or methadone or any other drug is theoretically inert, and that the logics of the drug and the logics of usage have to be understood at a certain level of granular detail before you're going to be able to do much in the way of effective, you know, kind of intervention. The other piece, Hungry Subjects, I finally got that off. And, you know, that's a much more how Jamie thinks piece, more than, you know, it doesn't pretend to be a contribution to, you know, some kind of applied medical anthropology, but it really does try to interrogate addiction, particularly the idea of appetite, hunger, in terms of a kind of a fundamental Western philosophical category. And I argue in that if you take seriously that the roots of the market-centered state is located in the work of Thomas Hobbes, but particularly the Leviathan, then, you know, you have to take seriously that appetite is a constituent theoretical impulse in kind of Western theorizing of the individual and society. And that a lot of our anxieties, particularly our anxieties around the, you know, various apocalyptic endings for ourselves or our civilization, climate change being the obvious one, are fundamentally stitched into this idea of out of control consumption. And out of control consumption so obviously echoes ideas of addiction. And I'm by no means the first to point that out, but what I am probably the most insistent on, that this, the logics of pleasure are a kind of a sideshow to this more fundamental idea of appetite. So that's the idea behind that paper.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And prompted by your answer, as an anthropologist, you then have made a use of participant observation as well as investigating socio-historical and cultural contexts. And it has provided a contribution to eventual change in healthcare services. Could you elaborate on how these methods have shaped the results of your work?
I'm not a modest man, but I don't think I can claim to have changed things quite yet. I think that if you take yourself professionally seriously, you have to, you know, particularly as an anthropologist, if you're working on certain kinds of subjects where you feel some kind of burden is laid on you because, you know, people in tough circumstances have shared their lives with you, you have a certain kind of job to make some space for questions to be asked. I think my career has impacted the health services enough in Ireland that some people are asking questions, some people are using terms, some people are thinking differently because of me. But I mean, it must be said, I've been very fortunate in my students too, who have infiltrated not just the academy, you know, with good academic jobs, but have also worked in the health system. You know, Maynooth has a history of taking mature students and second career students. So, you know, I have a couple of nurse PhDs that I produced, and people who have taken their anthropology and changed their own practice and changed some of the practices around them. So it's very hard to give, sort of like Foucault's thing about the authorial function, a name might be on there, but that doesn't really close the conversation about both who created it and kind of what was actually created. So I think participant observation is useful in a sense that it's a kind of idea of a method, and people think that they can get their heads around that. I think in practice, what you find that you do in that kind of health services research is somewhat unsatisfying from a kind of purist definition of participant observation. For example, tomorrow I'm heading up to the north of Ireland as part of this big project called SHAPES, which is looking at the life worlds of older people and, you know, across Europe. And I'm going to have our first, you know, myself and colleague are going up there to talk to a couple of people in person in their houses. And, you know, but if everything works out, it'll be about 6 hours over 2 days, you know, and I'll look at photo albums and some pieces and things like that. I'd be less inclined to call that participant observation, but I would be inclined to reserve, there's an ethnographic aura around that kind of interaction. And you often have the same thing with, you know, lots of people run focus groups, but an anthropologist who has gone through an experience of field work, you know, runs a very different kind of focus group than a sociologist who has never done that. And so I think that participant observation is a kind of experiential grid more than an easily peelable away kind of methodology that you can just hand off to somebody else and say, aha, this is what you have to do. We're never really going to see true participant observation in some of the smaller projects that I was kind of discussing earlier on, you know, where you know, nurses or doctors interrogate some of their own practice. But I think you can give people a feel for the kinds of questions that they should be at least reaching towards. So I'm a little uncomfortable with that being like what I'm importing into the care system. I think it's much more of I'm importing a set of, you know, sensibilities and questions, but more crucially kind of resources. And this is the thing too, that, you know, just as participant observation works in a way, because if you get told to, you know, basically fuck off in the field, that person will likely see you again. And, you know, if you get a no and, you know, for, hey, can we have a chat? It doesn't mean that no in April is going to be a no in June or in August. And in the same way, I think that these sort of continuous relationships with decision makers, carers, et cetera, sort of have to be maintained in the same kind of way, because it's not necessarily clear that when these things, you know, when this configuration of possibilities assemble itself, we say, yeah, we can actually do something here. And, you know, you're at the other end of that. And that's really a part of making a professional place in yourself, you know, for yourself in your own career. You have a job, you'll be a lecturer at some place, or, and you'll have a set of ideas about what you might want to do with respect to your own academic trajectory. But increasingly, people are doing these smaller projects at home or making themselves available in specific ways for much more localist, you know, kinds of, or within their own national boundaries kinds of issues. And those are really built on the same principles as participant observation, long-term relationships, you know, building up of trust, and wanting to really understand a problem basically before you come up with a solution to it. And I think if that's what you mean by participant observation, yeah, that's crucial. But I don't think that participant observation is a sort of magic methodology that will convert healthcare workers in there, you know, for the most part, it isn't. And so we have to sort of translate that to specific kind of ideas and even sensibilities that healthcare workers, for the most part, have. You know, I don't think it's as a locked door as it's often presented in the literature.
No, that's wonderful. That's really interesting. It makes the idea of participant observation much more concrete. Finally, to wrap up, how can you and your colleagues' work help healthcare providers or researchers understand illness beyond a strictly biomedical perspective?
You can find people who are wedded to the biomedical perspective. I actually think that most healthcare practitioners, even at like very high levels, like consultant levels, are not as strictly biomedical as they're sometimes portrayed. I think that what is needed, well, there's a couple of things. Let's break the question apart. There's a structural issue. That structural issue in the care system as such is that if the political masters of a care system think that it has to be running at or near 100% efficiency in order to provide value for money, not only won't anything change, everything will get worse as things go on. Because when a system running at 100% efficiency fails, it doesn't fail slowly. The wheels come off and there's a crash. And that's why you very often see scandals, you know, where, you know, that based on race or access or consistent set of the same mistakes being made over and over for years, because literally no one has any space for reflection or thinking. So there's a structural problem within particularly how a kind of, I hate the word neoliberal, but a particular kind of government that's trying to get value for money for the taxpayer conceives of this issue. Then there is the other question that I alluded to earlier, that in, you know, the quality and patient health safety kind of literature, which is like, just because you don't necessarily have something outside of the biomedical perspective on health and disease, doesn't mean that you're necessarily better than the biomedical. Many, you know, if you look at some of the most viciously right-wing, crazy, anti-vax websites in the United States, I have a couple of students working on this, so I've been reading a lot of that. I have my own kind of interests. I occasionally will publish some bits and pieces on Anglophone world's insanity with regard to certain things. But if you look at those sites, like Nature News, for example, they are stocked up with ideas of holistic care. They're stocked up with terms like natural balance. You know, frankly, they're crazy. They're fascist crazy. So like, it's not that the biomedical perspective or getting beyond the biomedical perspective is the be all and end all of improving care. And there's a wide swathe of things beyond the biomedical perspective, you know, from that is simply a diversion of resources, you know, but unlikely to really hurt people if it's done in an addition, like something like homeopathy, to stuff that could be, you know, really, really dangerous, you know, to patients and indeed family members, because they're out money often at the same time. So the question isn't so much biomedical bad and anything else good. The question is really, how does one get a much more textured idea of what these very powerful techniques, technologies, pharmaceuticals, et cetera, how can they be applied in the best possible way? And a lot of the feedback for when things are going wrong are actually within the biomedical paradigm. You know, people are dying, for example, or, you know, people aren't getting better for whatever reason. And so that takes another set of questions. One thing that I have to spend a lot of time on in talking to practitioners is like, is patient choice the logical place to start for patient centeredness? I mean, when you're very sick, or when you're bringing in like a loved one who's very sick, you're not thinking of care like buying shoes or buying, you know, a house. You're not making a series of plus minus calculations to kind of maximize some marginal utility. What you are looking for is a set of answers right now. Now, in chronic conditions, what, you know, that positionality of patient often changes dramatically. So within sometimes as little as a few months, for certain kinds of educated middle-class patients who suddenly discover they have a chronic disease, you might have somebody with a credible second-year medical school knowledge of their own syndrome. They're motivated, they're chasing stuff down. If they have access beyond paywalls, for example, you know, they could actually keep abreast of literature that sometimes even their specialist hasn't had a chance, you know, to see. So the target of care is always evolving. And that's something that a lot of chronic disease specialists can actually get their heads around. You know, they spend a lot of time worrying about something like that. And the better ones, you'll want to have kind of patients who understand themselves. What's often challenging in very marginal cases, you know, in the very marginal areas of medicine where, let's face it, you know, heroin users are not the most, there are very few poster children among heroin users. There's a layering of moral and health and social seeming failures that they're not taken particularly seriously as interlocutors. And, you know, that's also true for people with major mental illness, although it's a different set of valences. It's very hard to get, you know, like consultants to say, well, look, people become experts on the drugs in their own body. And that has to be taken seriously as well. Like if you want someone to stay on their antipsychotic meds, for example, if they keep telling you that there's a side effect that they find intolerable, you're doing themselves, yourself, and, you know, whatever trajectory that I might improve upon, any, you know, you're not doing it any favors by not listening to that individual. And so the questions about what to do about care, which I think which should be the focus rather than biomedicine, you know, that are much more granular than getting people to think outside of biomedicine. The much more serious question is, they're going to think about biomedicine. The question is how, what kinds of ways, you know, what kinds of resources can we bring to kind of nudge that speculation and that interest in a particular direction? What kinds of ways can we facilitate how people are actually working on that? I have a project on medical professionalism, and it's striking to me how slow medical schools have been to actually start to train doctors in a world where, you know, Dr. Google is being consulted sometimes while they're actually listening to you. And so the question is, you know, how do you help people curate information? And this is one of the huge problems where, you know, this vaccination debacle in some countries has really happened. Like, it never occurred to people that there was this much shit that people could get about, you know, information, even though, you know, we've had decades of anti-vax craziness around measles and MMR, going back to, you know, how many people who can associate the name of Andrew Wakefield and the autism scare in the 1990s, how many people know how tawdry that actually was, you know, where Wakefield was getting hundreds of thousands of dollars from an American lawyer to sort of try to find something that a class action suit in the United States could pick up on, you know, to sue vaccination makers for kids with autism. So the very the problem isn't the biomedical model or the biomedical way of thinking. It's how humans in concrete social historical circumstances who are trained to see the world in one way, understand the world in a, you know, more or less haphazard way, perhaps outside of that training, can best be brought along to ask a series of questions and to come up with a series of ways of answering those questions that will make things better for, you know, people who are often quite vulnerable, I mean, almost by definition.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. Saris, for sharing some of your work and your insights with us today. And thank you very much for being a part of the Collaborative Care Lab project with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.